Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak. The 44th annual Earth Day was the day before yesterday, so this is our Earth Day program on All Together Now. But, as you know, every day is Earth Day here, and why not? So the organization called Global Footprint Network sent out their annual update a few days ago, and among their findings is that global ecological overshoot continues to grow. Ecological overshoot now stands at 54% above the planet's biocapacity. That is, humanity demands more than 1.5 times more biocapacity than the amount our planet can renew. And, of course, the ecological footprints of the high-income countries in this report were more than triple that of the middle-income countries and were about 5 times that of the low-income countries. But as the recently published 5th assessment of climate change by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change noted, it is now much more feasible than in the past to get solar panels on every roof, because the price of photovoltaic cells in those panels has gone down 75% in the last few years. So all that's needed is for more governments to make a bigger push for ecological sanity. But meanwhile, as you know, the push has been in the opposite direction. And there have been stories about the Koch brothers. One of their new campaigns is in partnership with Grover Norquist, who, as you may recall, believes any taxation and any spending of public revenue is theft. So the Koch brothers and Grover Norquist have teamed up to go into state governments and convince them to stop any programs, incentive programs, support programs for solar energy. This is, you know, an unfair competition with the fossil fuel industry. And they've succeeded in 4 states to getting those pro-solar standing laws rescinded. And they're pushing hard in a lot more states, which is just incredible if you look at the facts in the IPCC report that just came out recently. And, of course, all the extreme weather we can see right here in our own country. So, no, the push is in the other direction, of course, and it's also in the direction of going after those last hard-to-get deposits of oil and natural gas by means of environmental, I would say, an environmental assault known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And you probably saw in the news that Vice President Biden went to Ukraine earlier this week to symbolically present the U.S. support package for Ukraine. You may not have known that part of that support package is the expectation and built-in assumption that Ukraine is going to go full speed ahead with fracking. I mean, can you imagine? After going through all that struggle and sacrifice to get out from under the thumb of Russia, only to then have your air and water poisoned by fracking? Well, one ray of light in the anti-fracking efforts was this court decision yesterday in Dallas concerning the Parr family who live in Wise County, Texas. They filed a successful $3 million lawsuit against Aruba Petroleum Company, the fracking company whose operations surrounded the Parr property and had caused all 3 members of the household a range of illnesses. Now, the Parr family's lawsuit was certainly not the first lawsuit to be brought against a fracking company for health-related damages. But with all the other ones, the companies pay a cash settlement along with stern gag orders. In this suit, the family was happy to say, no, no way, get out of the way, we're going to trial. They went to trial, and the victims prevailed, even though the fracking company pointed out that it knew it was making people sick, but It was just doing what the law allows. Not a good reason for poisoning people, the judge ruled. Now, some of you may have seen a featured article last Sunday in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about Paul Kingsnorth. Paul Kingsnorth is a 41-year-old Englishman who was an environmental activist for many years, which began in the 1990s while he was still studying for his degree in history at the University of Cambridge. And he arrived at a turning point, he says, about 6 years ago. Quote, I had a lot of friends who were writing about climate change and doing a lot of good work on it. I was just listening and looking at the facts and thinking, wow, we are really screwed here. We are not going to stop this from happening. So at that time, when he was looking, 2008, the first decade of the 21st century was shaping up to be the hottest in recorded history. In 2007, the Arctic Sea ice shrank to a level not seen in centuries. And the NASA climatologist, James Hansen, announced then that in order to elude the most devastating consequences, we'd need to maintain a level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of 350 parts per million, but we'd already surpassed 380, and since then it's reached 400 parts per million. Just a few days ago, they announced that the average concentration over the whole past last month was at 400. So Kingsnorth said, everything had gotten worse. You look at every trend that environmentalists like me have been trying to stop for 50 years, and every single thing had gotten worse. And I thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't sit here saying, yes, comrades, we must act. We need only one more push, and we'll save the world. I don't believe it. I don't believe it, so what do I do? Well, he wrote a manifesto called Uncivilization. And much of it was a very good critique of the whole blind faith in techno fixes, which are not going to stop this destruction of our physicality. And he's also founded something called the Dark Mountain Project. So he speaks a lot about mourning, grief, despair. He says, we're living through the age of ecocide. And like a long-dazed widower, we are finally becoming sensible to the magnitude of our loss, which it is our duty to face. So, in short, he says he's abandoned hope, but only false hope. He says that in response to critics, of course, who say we can't afford to take the posture you're assuming here. And again, Kingsnorth says, quote, it seems to me to be such a futile thing. What does hope mean? What are we hoping for? And why are we reduced to something so desperate? Surely we only hope when we are powerless, unquote. So instead of trying to save the earth, he says, people should start talking about what is actually possible. Well, hold that thought. He's gone on to write a number of pieces fulminating against environmentalism, including the 350.org organization, which I think is really counterproductive because it was absolutely crazy-making that there was no big organization taking this on until Bill McKibben and those recent graduates from Middlebury College a few years ago started 350.org, and it has been a big global effort, and thank goodness it's happening. Anyway, I read an article that Kingsnorth wrote a couple of years ago in Orion, and I was with him about three-quarters of the way through with his whole dismantling of the fantasy of techno-fixes from biotechnology and all. But to abandon hope, without, I think, without a multi-layered full-court press to stop the disintegration, it is true that there could be no hope. So is this a matter of fake it till you make it? I mean, that's what he's not willing to do. I'm not willing to have this false hope. It's just a fraudulent way to live. But I don't think it is a matter of fraudulent hope. And here's why. We simply do not know what is possible or impossible from moment to moment. We don't know enough about the possibilities which could still be coming together and forming to give up. For instance, the Rodale Institute a couple of days ago released a report entitled Regenerative Organic Agriculture and Climate Change, a Down-to-Earth Solution to Global Warming. And they state, quote, we could sequester more than 100% of the current annual carbon dioxide emissions with a switch to widely available and inexpensive organic management practices, which we term regenerative organic agriculture, unquote. So they say if management of all current cropland shifted to reflect the regenerative model as practiced at the research sites that they discuss, more than 40% of the annual carbon emissions could potentially be captured in healthy soil. The carbon is changed into being something that helps the soil in that situation. If, at the same time, all global pasture was managed on a regenerative model, an additional 71% could be sequestered. Essentially, passing the 100% mark means a drawing down of excess greenhouse gases, resulting in the reversal of the greenhouse effect. So, regenerative organic agriculture, they explain, is comprised of a number of organic practices. I don't know what all of them mean. There's a long list. But you see what I mean here. There are always new, very smart possibilities. I believe we do need to look directly at the hair-raising facts of what is happening. And I think that to refuse to do so is morally irresponsible. And a whole lot of people today are still refusing to look at what's happening. But then, we need to hold both options in our minds. There may well be no hope, but there is hope. After all, there's so many times in our lives when we've had to hold both of those thoughts in our minds. This is really tough. This may well not work. This has to work. I'm going to push on and persevere. So it's not an unusual response for us to make in difficult situations. The main point is just that we do not know what could happen, as there are so many variables. All we do know for sure is that if we, our governments and our societies, keep on doing what we've been doing, the ecocide is not going to be halted and not going to be healed. I'll be interested to hear what my guest today has to say about Paul Kingsnorth's conclusion later on, as he's a very deep person I've listened to with admiration at several conferences over the years. My guest today is John A. Grimm. He is coordinator of the International and Interreligious Forum on Religion and Ecology with Mary Evelyn Tucker. They have co-authored a new book, Ecology and Religion, which we'll hear about. He is also co-author of an entire series of books entitled World Religions and Ecology. These were a project of Harvard Divinity School's Center for the Study of World Religions over many years. In that series, he edited the volume entitled Indigenous Traditions and Ecology, quote, the Interbeing of Cosmology and Community. John Grimm earned a PhD in religion under the mentorship of the late Thomas Berry. He's a senior lecturer and research scholar at Yale, where he teaches courses on Native American and Indigenous religions, as well as world religions and religion and ecology. He's the author of The Shaman, Patterns of Religious Healing Among the Ojibwe Indians. He is an executive producer of the film Journey of the Universe, which you may have seen on your local PBS station last year or so. And he is also the co-editor with Mary Ellen Tucker of a wonderful anthology entitled Worldviews and Ecology. John Grimm, welcome to the program.
Hello, Charlene. It's so good to be with you.
Well, I would like to put this new book in context a little bit. I think you and your academic and activist partner and wife, Dr. Mary Evelyn Tucker, I have really done more than any two people I can think of to bring to the fore in all the religious traditions around the world their teachings on how humans should relate to the rest of the natural world. They all have something to say, a little or a lot, about these ecological issues. But it wasn't really clear until you brought all those scholars together. You've now amassed so many books on this subject. And also, I think with your anthology, Worldviews and Ecology, it was another attempt to say, ecology is not something out on the side. It's embedded not only in every religious tradition, in every worldview of what a human is, how we might function here on our blue-green planet. So I think you've really done so much to integrate ecology with the contextual discourse of our times. And this new book, Ecology and Religion, it's not an anthology. It's written entirely by yourself and Mary Evelyn Tucker. Why don't you tell us who it is you're hoping to reach with this and the main idea? Because I like this, the four fundamental aspects of religious life you talk about, orienting, grounding, nurturing, transforming.
Yes.
So how are you bringing this to people's attention in this time of what I would consider extreme urgency?
Yes, what a wonderful leading question, Charlene, to step up to the plate. First of all, with listening to your opening remarks, I'm reminded how much encouragement a person can receive. And in these comments that you've made, you're so encouraging to mention the work that Mary Evelyn and I have tried to do, and that strikes me as an interesting one response that we might take up later in our conversation about the position that Paul Kingsnorth has taken up, and we'll save that perhaps for a few moments. But
yeah, the second half, okay.
Yes, and it brings me to your encouragement causes us to go forward in this work, and it's a wonderful accompaniment, and in fact, I would call it a virtue also to hope that one has to be called out and encouraged, and that's how I see this work that we've been doing, Charlene, and this work on ecology and religion it's interesting to even consider the title. Island Press is the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first came to Island Press with this proposal through our former dean, Gus Beth, and Gus had suggested that we develop our religion and ecology work, and when Island Press saw the possibilities, they asked us if we would reverse our accustomed title to Ecology and Religion, because their target audience has largely been scientists.
Mm-hmm.
In the environmental movement, and they thought that the word ecology would bring them into the discussion more immediately than the word religion as the mm-hmm. lead term.
Uh-huh.
So that's an interesting comment on the title itself. But to situate this book in terms of our larger work, we see ourselves, Mary Evelyn and myself, as trying to attend both to a field and a force.
Hmm.
And by field, I mean the effort to develop an academic field of religion and ecology. And this effort then takes place not only here at Yale, where we have a joint degree program, but also it's a collaborative project through all of the hundreds of faculty teaching in colleges and universities, as well as high school teachers who are entering into this subject also, mm-hmm. that we're beginning to develop this network of people who are attending to the works in the field and then are also connected with those engaged in the religions with what we're calling the force of this project, namely religious environmentalism, mm-hmm. on-the-ground activities by the religious traditions around the world. By that I mean from the Evangelical Environmental Network among the Christian evangelical community to the shores of the Yamuna River, where groups in the Vaishnavite tradition focused on the deity of Krishna are actively engaged in religious environmentalism there to clean the Yamuna River. So we find, and I could go on, and perhaps later in our remarks we might talk about some of the projects that are undertaken, but in this book, we wanted to explore the field especially to contribute more to the ongoing study of religion and ecology and the reflection upon these possibilities. And as you so correctly pointed out in your opening remarks, this is not something new. If we look at these religious traditions, it's possible to see very diverse commitments by individuals and communities to interactions with the natural world, with local bioregions, with an understanding of how the term that we now use, ecosystems, how life in a region interacted.
Mm-hmm.
So that,
well,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I definitely do want to hear about that later, because myself was a little disappointed. A couple of years ago, I was sent a book to review by National Catholic Reporter, and
yes.
They said, you want to read this book on churches and environmental activism? And I said, yeah, sure, I really would like to read that, because I think there's no other institution that both has a presence in every neighborhood and at the national and at the planetary level. So
yes.
The potential is huge. So I read it, and I was very disappointed. This was only in the United States, I admit, to see that most of them were what you might call lifestyle changes, only for the church instead of a person. So they were, you know, greening their physical plant and planting a garden by the church and maybe doing a little ecological restoration. But I had thought they'd be pressing the city council and pressing the state legislature, and, you know, because this is really a political problem as well as on every other level. It's a moral, ethical, and
yes.
spiritual problem. And, you know, and almost all the examples in the book but one group went to the state capitol to lobby for something. So, yes, I do want to
yeah.
get to that in the second half, but I don't want to give mm-hmm. a short shrift to this new book. So why don't you first start giving us the overview? I thought it was very interesting that you open with discussing with the reader both the promise of religions in this area and the problems.
Yes, actually we open with our personal stories.
In the introduction, yeah, sure.
Yes, Mary Evelyn's journey into the East Asian world and my own exchange with indigenous, especially Native Americans, First Nations peoples.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important also in the sense of foregrounding and letting people know where we're coming from. But then, as you point out, the question of what do the religions bring to the table and what problems become obstacles. And I think you've rightly identified within a number of traditions we could raise this question about a limited understanding of where environmental change resides.
Mm-hmm,
is it
mm-hmm.
simply in personal activities, or is it in addressing the larger issues of the cultural setting as well as deep transformation? And I think they go very much hand in hand, where a change of mind and heart and body We need to work on all of these levels, and consequently the field and the force. You can see where I'm trying to find metaphors that resonate with the mm-hmm. depth of change that we need. Recently, I think it's interesting to consider, Mary Evelyn and I joined the Bishop of the Episcopal Church in America, Catherine Jefferts Schori, mm-hmm. and the Swedish Bishop of the Lutheran Church, and also the head of the Bishop of the Lutheran Church in America, and also the Methodist leadership, uh-huh. to lobby down in Washington for environmental concerns, especially regarding climate change. And so, Charlene, just to give you some sense that we could not even get in the door of Republican congresspeople. They would not even give us a hearing. And when we spoke, for example, with Nancy Pelosi's staff mm-hmm. and the climate change expert that she had, he lamented the fact that to introduce any discussion or legislation that has the word environmental in it completely subverts it now from the standpoint of the bipartisan polarity that we have in our Congress. I think this pervades some of the country too. I had recently a discussion with a young student, a high school student, where I was asking them, well, what are you working on? What are you interested in? And he mentioned especially some social justice issues, which I was very pleased, of course, to hear. And I mentioned to him, well, how about environmental issues? And he said, no, I'm not working on that because you can't get anywhere with legislation.
Oh,
so this impact.
That's very interesting.
That
usually
feel.
They say because it takes away attention from social, but now it's because why bother? How
yes.
interesting.
And I think people are beginning
John,
see the connection of social and eco. Yeah.
Yeah. No, eco-social. I have tried so many times to get that into statements on the United Religions Initiative, the World Parliament of Religions. I get it put into the draft. It got taken out. But
it's
anyway,
happening, though.
Yeah,
it's slow, incremental change.
The opposition, what you said about environmentalism, they've done that to the term liberal, the term environmentalist, and the term feminist. And, of course,
yes.
you know, these are the big critiques of the status
yes.
quo. You know, uh-huh. what's happening to the working class? The liberals are supposed to be protecting that. And, you know, what's really going on here with patriarchy? And, you know, by the way, we're poisoning our context here, the environment. So those three deep critiques have just been demonized by changing the meaning of the label, as you say.
Yes, and still, with this effort to subvert, we're all aware that there has been incredible movement in this area.
That's right.
And so also in this question of religion and ecology, in this book, when we speak about religious ecologies, for example, we're trying to get this at this idea that embedded within the religions, if you look at Psalm 104 and the attention to the earth in Psalm 104, or look at the Rig Veda in Hinduism and see in those scriptures this close reading of the natural world and the place of the human in relationship and the understanding of the sacred in those relationships, that this sense of religious ecology is also very firmly established.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now seeing preachers at the pulpit who are able to draw on materials, and because of the forum materials, the website, they can also draw on active issues, engaged issues, where projects are taking place on the ground. So I don't want to overstate it, and I think that's where Paul Kingsnorth is correct in drawing attention to false hope.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
Your point about not losing hope is also crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that's where we're seeing preachers who are making these tentative connections about
yeah.
religious ecologies and projects on the ground.
Right. Mm. Well, that's because you two and all your colleagues, all of us, I think you more than anyone really have tried to bring this to the fore. You've been leaders in bringing it. It's in all the religions, but you bring it to full attention, which has been so important. Okay, we need to pause now for the break. This
Good.
Is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, John Grimm, author, co-author of the new book, Ecology and Religion. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, John Grimm, co-author of Ecology and Religion. And I would like to refer listeners to their wonderful website. It's a little easier if you just put it into a search box than my giving you the address here. So just Google or whatever, Forum on Religion and Ecology, F-O-R-E. And then you will see all the riches they offer there. Okay, I want to just begin by giving people a quick view of what's in this book. And after the contextual opening chapters, I was happy to see that you arrived at the conclusion I'd arrived at when I wrote States of Grace back in 1991, that certain religious traditions seem to really focus on a particular aspect of existence, not to the exclusion of others, but they just go very deeply into a particular aspect. So you write here about Christianity as orienting to the cosmos, Confucianism as grounding in community, indigenous traditions and the nurturing powers of nature, Hinduism and the transforming effect of devotion. And then you end with this idea of an interreligious dialogue toward a global ethics, and finally, creating ecological cultures. But I want to ask you something that's bothered me. I've seen some articles in the last year or so saying, oh, I see, what we need now is an ethical approach to the environmental crisis. You know, we'll bring ethics into this, not from you, from other directions. And I thought, well, isn't that obvious? I mean,
yes.
Don't people know that it's the wrong thing to do to poison the rest of the planet? We're not here to kill off the planet, whatever reason we might be here for. And it's just that the economic forces are just running roughshod over what everybody must recognize as the ethical problem. So what is your sense of building a new ethics?
Yes, I sense the penetrating character of that question, Charlene, because I associate ethics in my own studies with a rational understanding of human behavior.
Oh.
And so, the question of morality is a little messier. Every activity, is it moral or not? But ethics is a higher ground in the sense that it positions itself in that area of rationality and the capacity of the human to think with all of our cognitive powers intact. And that corresponds very nicely to many of the concerns in our present times, where we're interested in the rational capacity of the human as a rational animal, and we also want to monetize everything. And so there's been this movement in the environmental studies to consider the services that ecosystems provide, and that we can monetize those services.
Yeah.
And in fairness, this has been an extremely helpful bridge.
One more tool,
The commercial community. So it is. It's not to be denied. But at the same time, if we reduce the natural world to the metaphors or consideration of this rational act of monetizing, then we miss so much of other ways of knowing the world, other ways of interacting. And actually, Charlene, that's one of the major motivations for Mary Evelyn and myself in our efforts to situate the voices of the different religions in this regard, because they bring so much more to the table than simply a rational analysis. They bring embodied ways of ritual relationship with the natural world, certainly within the indigenous traditions. If you think of simply the character of dancing, or the act of dancing on the earth, and feeling that as a religious act. And if we move then into processions in the, say, the major Axial Age traditions or so-called world religions, and the symbolic consciousness that pervades those traditions, they're often very juicy and filled with affect and emotion.
That's right, and wisdom, a deep wisdom about being on the earth. But, you know, with everyone schooled in the mechanistic worldview, they become tone deaf to hearing what you just said. It doesn't carry any weight compared to, well, we all survive because the economy is expanding, so we just need to keep focused on that. You know, I think that's the problem. Modernity really marginalizes religion, which is why, of course, the fundamentalist versions have come roaring back into the center, because it never did work out a respectful place for religion. So
I think there's a place there. Also, the community.
Sorry?
The role of community, along with, as you say, the surge of fundamentalist response to this rationality, and also community. And Charlene, I also wanted to revisit a point that I think Paul Kingsnorth makes. It's a very interesting point where he talks about the facing up to what's ahead, and he uses the metaphor of terminal illness and the capacity of a person who is in the terminal stage of their life to recognize and to enter and take responsibility for that. Now, whether or not we're in a terminal era, I don't have the capacity to say, but the reality of his metaphor strikes me as there's something appropriate in terms of our current situation also, of recognizing, as you say, the religions are often marginalized, but to take responsibility for what we have done on this planet.
Exactly.
So part of what you just very kindly pointed out in the table of contents here, what we're trying to do is a combination of what Thomas Berry, so many decades ago, when we studied with him, and he was puzzling over the relationship of religion, say, interreligious dialogue, to use that term. What do the religions say to one another? And part of his insight was that the religions, as you said earlier, they have a depth in one area especially, where there seem to be especially filled with wisdom insights into this, or say the suffering dimension of Buddhism, or the compassion and love within Christianity, and the sense of a covenantal community within Judaism, and these special insights. So Berry would emphasize that these traditions, in many ways, they complement one another and they complete one another. So it was that teaching that he gave us that we brought into this project on religion and ecology, where we began to see that these religions also, in concert, say much more than they do simply as singular traditions.
Right.
And so our effort has been actually to redefine the phrase world's religions, and to remove the apostrophe S, because the old phrase world's religion seemed to set a bar that once a religion reached a certain capacity of insight, they were available to all humans. And of course, that Hegelian universalizing of religion, it fit the colonial model very well. Because Christianity was the height of the bar, and as soon as the tradition reached something like that, they became a universal world religion.
Right.
But in revisiting that phrase, what we want to do now is to pick up on Berry's understanding of complementing and completing, and seeing that all of them come out of this world. They do not come from Mars. They are part of the soil and fabric. They're grounded in this earth that we live on. And so the world religions coming out of the world, when we look at them, they have these ecological insights, hence the phrase that we're putting for religious ecologies. And they talk about the nature of reality in their stories, their cosmologies. So religious cosmologies and religious ecologies, that's what we see the dynamic occurring in ritual activity, and what's narrated in myths and acted out in these traditions.
Yeah. I have been very encouraged by all the grassroots political actions.
Yes.
And I want to say I used to love reading them on the earlier version of your website, but maybe it's just me. I couldn't find them on the new version, so I'm just putting in a listener's plug to get them back. Did I miss them?
Underneath, if you go to the World Religions on that particular button on the Forum on Religion website, underneath each tradition, if you click on one of the traditions, say Christianity.
Oh, I see. You go into each tradition first, and then
yes,
it'll happen.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Great.
Christianity
Well, why don't
has,
you tell, we have about 5 minutes, but why don't you give the listeners some examples of these grassroots projects?
Yes, I think, Charlene, one way to consider it is that there are many religious traditions that are nationally focused. So say, for example, Interfaith Power and Light.
Yeah.
They're found throughout the country, and they're oriented on...
when you say found, there are chapters in towns
that's
and
right.
cities all over... Right.
That's exactly
yeah,
right.
Interreligious and chapters in towns and cities, yeah.
To help generate energy audits in churches... and a attention to environmental questions and within particular denominations. And then Catholic Rural Life is increasingly focused on environmental issues. And you mentioned the Evangelical Environmental Network, and I'd put side by side with that the Indigenous Environmental Network, an excellent resource on how Native communities are standing in solidarity with one another to resist degrading environmental projects, especially the tar sands. So then also, Charlene, there are international religious activities that are engaged projects, and then also thematically focused, like climate change, the Catholic Climate Change Project. And this would be one way to think about these different engaged projects around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And even in China now, the phrase that we use at the end of our book, ecological cultures, we find this phrase being developed mostly in the context of East Asia now, and especially China, where the revival of Confucianism is providing a setting and a platform for thinking about not simply change to address that environmental issue or this particular environmental problem, but a deeper a cultural change that has an ecological basis.
Mm-hmm.
And to be frank, these are uphill battles, they're struggles in the face of a country that's entirely committed to its economic agenda. But at the same time, there are over 70,000 environmental protests every year in China, so that these issues cannot be simply avoided.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find emerging there small organizations that are beginning to understand there's a deeper transformational issue here. One could say a spiritual issue or bring religious language to it, but we know the history of China recently and their turn from organized religions, but still there is attention to the deep and, again, ethical questions here. Whether we frame them as philosophical, they are still the cultural value surface. And these are very deep Taoist, Confucian, Buddhist values that are embedded in the cultural DNA. And so religious environmentalism, there takes different shapes, but it still has this spiritual and religious character to it.
Well, one thing they would have to do, as would religious environmental activists everywhere, is get up to speed on the pragmatic, better ways to do things so that they can present those. You know, A,
exactly.
Our tradition tells us this is important, and B, solar photovoltaics have just gone down 75% in cost, so why don't you rethink the policy in our city, you know, on helping get solar panels on every roof. I mean, it needs to be... You know, the ethics and we have in hand here all these new, better ways of doing things.
Exactly.
I mean, the information is what we have in hand.
Yes, it's technology that assists our efforts to address these issues rather than technology which overwhelms, subverts, and distracts us.
Yeah. Or even the, you know, biotechnology that really does not solve the problem at all. It just goes on to new bells and whistles. And the yeah. other thing I think about listening to you is, you know, you say, okay, these church groups really can't get anywhere if they go to Washington or their state capitals. As we all know, almost every vote in this country is bought and paid for because of our electoral system. And the people in office are desperately in need of keeping those big campaign mm-hmm. contributions coming in. So they have to please yeah. the big donors who give those.
Yes,
so
there's that.
They're not going to listen to other people. But, you know, I always say they have the money, but we have the numbers. So couldn't there be, do they not want to go, I know it's a problem now with the, you know, nonprofit status, but so many churches have, you know, said, according to our tradition, it's important to do ABC, so we hope you would vote for people who are in favor of that, you know, kind of general things. I mean, all the numbers of people in organized religions, couldn't they get together and say, you know, not from the pulpit, but just the groups, we're not voting for anybody anymore who's going to keep poisoning and murdering the creation.
Yes.
So unless
yes.
we hear a strong, what you are actually going to do in your first 6 months in office, you are not getting our vote. I mean, what about
you.
Pressuring them in the only place they fear, which is the polling place?
Mm. Yes, Charlene, I want to both affirm
John,
the comment
John,
you're making and then also...
John, I am so sorry. I just looked at the clock. We're having too good a time here. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming on the program, John Grimm.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Oh, well, let's amble on over to the Arts Corner here. Our poem for this Earth Day program is Who Writes by Maria Grothwall. Just sit back and feel your expansive, ecological, and cosmological self. Who Writes? Galaxies write, spiraling poems of elegant beauty, pushing words of stars, planets, and moons across pages of space-time. Stars write, transforming potential into press and weight of presence, creating from hydrogen, helium, and gravity the vowels and consonants of matter. Planets write, stringing sounds of atomic elements into paragraphs, pages, and scrolls of landscape and seashore, vast storms and thick, solid rock. This planet writes, savanna, tundra, and hardwood forest, call of raven, spiral of snake, drift of leaf, first laugh of child. Long stories of fin, feather, fur, skin, and those sung epics of genetic structure and tectonic plate. Who pushes the pen across the page on your lap? Who ignites the muscles of hand and heart when we write? Who the fire in our brains, the ache in our gut, the gasp of pleasure that keeps us up half the night, writing, that drives us through forgotten meals, writing, that lets the coffee get cold and the phone unanswered, writing? Who? Who sleeps dormant, a fog of no thought, pre-whisper even, dust on an old mirror? Who? Who stirs unexpectedly, labors persistently, edits constantly? Who can't get the words out fast enough? Who is never really silent? Who is loved and loved first, last, and always by us who write? Who? Who writes? Living planet of innumerable intricacies? Alchemist star making elements? Seeding life? Graceful galaxy birthing stars? Omnipresent, fertile universe? Who writes? Today, being human, universe speaks. I choose, Earth writes, today, as a woman. For our song this week, I'm sure you've heard on the news about the earthquakes in northeastern Ohio that have irrefutably been caused by fracking. It's now been established. I know a lot of you are involved in community or statewide campaigns to save your groundwater from being poisoned by toxic fracking chemicals, save your air from being polluted by the methane gas releases, and to save terra firma from rumbling asunder. Also, a few people can export fracked oil and gas. So here's a song written and performed by Carole King that we'll call The Fracking Song. Here it is. That was Carole King with I Feel the Earth Move. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on May 8th. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that we know.